ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
We all know air pollution is a health risk. We've invested billions of dollars in this country trying to clean up the problem, but there are still a lot of unanswered questions about exactly what diseases and health conditions may be caused by breathing polluted air. On this edition of UWM Today, we meet a public health expert who received a multi-million dollar grant from the federal government to try to come up with some answers to those questions. Amy Kalkbrenner is an assistant professor of environmental health sciences at UWM's Zilber School of Public Health. She received a $2.3 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to study whether autism or other neurological problems might be caused by breathing bad air. And we welcome you to the program today, Amy. Great to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Tom. I love talking about research and the connection between research and making the world a better place.
You know, we all know, just intuitively, that that bad air isn't good for our lungs. It isn't good for the way we feel, our eyes run. But there may be often a lot more serious problems than a runny nose or runny eyes, isn't there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So increasingly, we're understanding that the air pollution that you breathe may have an impact on your brain, or especially the brain of a baby that's developing during pregnancy and after. If you can bear with me, I would actually like to draw an analogy, which could perhaps help understand this. So there are some connections between air and diet. So air contains something that you need. Oxygen, namely. It also contains, you know, small levels of some trace toxins or poisons. Similarly, diet obviously contains many things that we need and perhaps maybe little bits of things that we don't. We know that what we eat doesn't just stay on our digestive tract, right? We're very familiar with the fact that what we eat critically impacts our entire body. And the same is true for air pollution. It is brought in through the lungs, but then we know that some of those constituents of air pollution, whether it's a particulate matter, which is also known as soot, whether it's a volatile organic compound, things like formaldehyde and benzene, we're even breathing in metals, that they're not just staying at the lung, that they're either moving through the body, some of them, and otherwise they might be causing some impact, biologic impact of the lung, and that impact then can move throughout the entire body.
How big are these particles, or I should say, how small are they in order to, you know, get into our bloodstream? And go ahead and create other problems.
Yes, absolutely. And to be crystal clear, we're not always sure whether it's the particle itself that may be getting into the bloodstream. This is an area of active research that perhaps we could talk more about. But you asked how small are the particles. Oftentimes, if you think about the diameter of a human hair, which is quite small, they're less than that. And oftentimes we talk about PM10, particulate matter 10, which is a little bit larger. It's the diameter less than 10 micrometers, or PM2.5, which is less than 2.5 micrometers in diameter. It's especially those smaller particles, which we think are getting deeper into the lungs, really causing an irritant or inflammatory response, and that may be responsible for a lot of the impacts of air pollution.
Now, your focus is on neurological impacts, right?
Correct.
But there are many, many other obvious problems that come from breathing polluted air, not the least of which are complications of asthma and lung cancer.
Absolutely.
Right? So there are things that are more readily apparent because, what, they manifest themselves in a physical form.
Yes, I think it's not only the physical form, but the fact that it was just natural for us to begin thinking that air pollution would first impact the lungs, or mostly impact the lungs. I think this is compounded with the fact that air pollution is for the most part invisible. You know, you might not think that we have air pollution in Milwaukee because we generally don't see visible fog, so, or smog rather. So we have this idea that this thing that's invisible, you know, it's coming in into the lungs. And so naturally, researchers first started looking at impacts like lung cancer, like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and like asthma. it's actually only in the last few decades that we more understand the biologic impacts of air pollution that cause us to start to say, well, wait, let's go beyond the lungs. So believe it or not, researchers are really looking and finding links with factors all over the spectrum, finding perhaps connections between air pollutants and preterm birth, between air pollutants and later life impacts such as heart disease. So there's really an understanding of how widely across the body and across the lifespan air pollution may be impacting us.
Well, you got this big grant from the National Institutes of Health to look specifically at the impact air pollution has on our brains, on the way in which we think and we process thoughts. Let's talk about that work. What specifically are you looking for and how are you going about doing it?
Yes. So this grant specifically is able to leverage a very unique data resource. Believe it or not, the data is from Denmark. And what's happening there is that they are able to have information across the entire population of people living in Denmark. That gives us a really large sample size, which many people likely know, really helps us to resolve more subtle impacts of what's going on with the air pollution. Even more importantly than that, we know a bit about these people's genetic makeup. So oftentimes people are looking at, is it genes or environment? But increasingly we understand that it's actually the genes plus environment. What I mean by that is that your genetic makeup may really increase your susceptibility to any sorts of environmental pollution or air pollutants. Perhaps you're not able to get rid of the toxin itself, or your body breaks it down into a slightly different chemical.
Some people could be breathing the same air and have different reactions to it, even though the same chemicals are coming into your lungs.
That's exactly right. So it's a matter of perhaps a susceptibility, or maybe some people are more resilient. They're able to get rid of the toxic influence of the air pollution. Maybe they have other factors which are really influencing that brain development. So that then the air pollution becomes that kind of final straw that pushes things over into an unfortunate manifestation of a problem with the brain.
Wow. So this particular grant is using these big data sets, right? So
correct.
You're drilling in. So are you looking at the life experiences of this population in Denmark? Are you looking at what from birth to death, or how big of a chunk of the lives
question.
Of people?
We're really focusing on early life here. So we know where pregnant women lived. We know also where they worked. And so we're taking the air pollution, the outside air pollution, from both of those locations.
Because that was measured at the same time that these people were being tracked.
Correct. So we're working with some collaborators who really have a fabulous way of estimating the air pollution that was going on precisely at that point in time. Then we are also continuing after the child's born for a couple of years. We really think that when it comes to the developing brain, we know that during pregnancy and the first couple of years of life is really key in terms of making sure that everything is developing properly. So its impacts to something during that time that could lead to a problem that might manifest as autism. It might manifest as an attention deficit disorder. It might manifest as some sort of cognitive decrement or other types of neurological problems.
And how far along are you in the research to perhaps draw any conclusions?
We don't yet have conclusions regarding our specific question about air pollution and autism. So that work is well underway.
So why Denmark? Why aren't we doing that in Milwaukee or in Pennsylvania? Or are those populations also being studied and we just don't have enough information on our city here domestically?
I will mention that I have done studies that involve air pollution and people in Milwaukee. This particular study is taking place in Denmark because of this unique data resource. So in the United States, our healthcare is delivered sort of piecemeal, bit by bit, different hospitals, different networks in different parts of the country. In Denmark, the system's different. It is more homogenized, and they have systematic records that go across the entire population. Furthermore, Denmark has allowed the use of these records for public health research. I should say that me and my colleagues who work with this data have to undergo some very rigorous training in protecting this data and have to live in Denmark for at least a month to have the privilege of working with these Danish collaborators on this special data resource.
Wow.
So we do take those precautions very seriously.
Do you have to speak the language? Do you ever talk to the individuals themselves, or are you just looking at the statistics behind the name?
Sadly, I do not speak Danish. It would really help in terms of working with my collaborators, although they are all very fabulously proficient in English. We do not ever interact with the people who are in this study. We're using information that was collected on them for either their medical care or just through, living in the country, such as information on where they live.
Yeah. So as you take a look at the data, are you focused? Your focus right now is on the early stage development of people's brains. Are you looking at the mums? Are you focusing on the children themselves, or perhaps some combination?
We're really looking at the children in terms of what happens to them, in terms of being diagnosed with some sort of neurological problem. So we include their mothers because of the air pollution exposure that took place during pregnancy. Then we follow their offspring, and we found out what kind of diagnosis that they may have. One of the innovations of our study is that we are looking at autism. We are looking at attention deficit disorders, also known as ADHD. But we're also looking at the combination of both of those, which is not as uncommon as you might think. Increasingly, we understand that looking at a person's brain and behavior isn't as simple as a yes or no diagnosis. And by looking at the combination of both of those things together now, we can get a better picture of what's really going on with that person's behavioral functioning.
And so the pollutants, let's talk about the air that they have been breathing that may have led to some problems. Is it unique? Is there something that is in the environment in Denmark that provides what markers or some signals of what might end up in the body? Or is air pollution pretty much the same wherever you go in the world?
Yeah, so air pollution in Denmark has a lot of overlap with the air pollution that you would find here in Wisconsin. The reason why has to do with the sources of air pollution. A lot of the air pollution that we're studying comes from vehicle emissions. So the vehicle emission byproducts that are coming out here in Wisconsin are also coming out there in Denmark.
Internal combustion engines work the same on either side of the ocean.
Exactly, exactly. You're going to have some subtle differences, influences of weather and other things that are different between Denmark and the U.S. You may have also been getting at a concern, perhaps, that air pollution may be less in Denmark. I'm not sure if you were getting at that, but I'm going to jump in and answer that. Yep, I'm going to answer that question anyway. So there is air pollution in Denmark, and there is a range of it. If you look at air pollution in Denmark compared to the U.S., largely the levels overlap, with the U.S. having some higher levels than Denmark. But it's largely overlapping.
When I've traveled in Europe, I'm struck by how many diesel engines are operating. And I wonder whether or not that may be different from what you see here. Diesels, you see on trucks and some vehicles, but it seems to me far less than you would in a country in Europe.
Yes. So, Tom, you actually did zero in right on one of the differences that might matter, which is the greater use of diesel in Europe versus the U.S. Because of that, you are going to have some differences in the constituents. You may know that individuals were, and the car companies themselves, were incentivized to move more toward diesel than we were here in the U.S. That led to those differences. And so we will see a slightly different ratio, for example, of nitrogen dioxide, NO2, to particulate matter, PM2.5. These are two very important pollutants that can lead to health impacts, and these are the two pollutants that we are focusing on in this new study.
Because there's more of it in Denmark, in the diesel fuel. So the question is the diesel fuel, when it burns, more harmful than regular gasoline?
I'm not sure if I'm able to speak to an increased harm because because of the limited understanding that we have right now of which exact constituent it might be within the air pollution.
Got it. And I only ask because I hate the smell of diesel. And so I would jump to the conclusion that because it smells so awful to me, it's got to be worse for you, but not necessarily.
Well, there is some evidence that diesel combustion can be worse for health. This is a very interesting balancing act because on the other hand, diesel combustion may not be quite as bad for a changing climate. So here you may have this counterbalancing factor between changing climate and health. Of course, the real answer is maybe let's just reduce all of our use of fuel.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio is Amy Alkbrenner. Amy is an associate professor at the Zilber School of Public Health. Her focus is environmental health sciences, and we're talking about a major research project she is involved in, one funded by the federal government, the National Institutes of Health, looking at the possible link between air pollution and neurological problems. Amy, you've mentioned several times colleagues that you're working with. Are those colleagues from other universities here in the country or around the world, or are your colleagues here in Milwaukee also involved in this study?
Yeah, so both. I'd like to highlight my colleague, Dr. Chang Zheng, who is here at UWM. He is a biostatistician in the Zilber School of Public Health. And also Dr. Jamie Schauer, who is just an hour away at UW-Madison. Then, as well, I am working with colleagues in Denmark and several of them at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore.
So they're all looking at this unique data set that exists in Denmark. So you're all drawn to that same pool of data?
Correct. And, well, that pool of data. And then I also do research that involves other data resources as well. So my focus is air pollution and brain development, but not all of it is done with the Danish data resource.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that you have studied air pollution here in Milwaukee. Let's talk about that project a bit.
Absolutely. I'd love to, because Milwaukee is where I live and where I am here, you know, with you right now.
And we're breathing the air here, right?
Indeed, so we are breathing the air.
We have a personal interest in this.
Yes.
What did you find?
Sure. So I'd actually like to talk about a study that looked at 155 individual components of air pollution. So air pollution is not just one thing. It's really this mixture. So here I'm talking again about the metals, things like mercury, volatile organic compounds, perhaps benzene and particulate matter. And this study was not focused just on Milwaukee. It was Milwaukee also and looking at people that lived all across the United States who had participated voluntarily with their families in a study of autism called the Autism Genetic Resource Exchange. So here what our goal was really to identify a possible bad actor chemical. You know, a few minutes ago, we were talking about how diesel versus non-diesel combustion may have different ratios of chemicals. And really, in terms of making the air cleaner, one thing you might want to know is, well, which one is worse? And is there some way we could perhaps reformulate gasoline, reformulate the engines, do something to really deal with the part of it that's really harming health? So what we did here is we really tried to look at a whole suite, as I mentioned, 155 air pollutants, and really try to disentangle, you know, were one or a handful of them the ones that were really looking like they were leading to impairments associated with autism?
So not every chemical that comes out of the tailpipe of a vehicle is necessarily as bad as the one next to it.
Exactly. And in this study, we were looking at air pollutants that came from all sources. So vehicle emissions, certainly important. Also very important are power plants, especially coal-fired power plants. And then there are other sources, factory smokestacks, the things that you might typically think of as being associated with air pollutants. So we're looking at the whole suite here, and we're trying to disentangle which one of those might be more responsible for the associations that we've observed.
What did you find?
Two pollutants kind of rose to the top of the heap, as you were. One of them is called propionaldehyde. It's not really a chemical that I had heard much about before. It is something that comes predominantly from vehicle emissions, so it's consistent with our previous findings and those of others. One other chemical gladly has now been taken out of gasoline, and this is a chemical that's abbreviated as MTBE, stands for methyl tert butyl ether. And it was a gasoline additive that was taken out in the mid-2000s. So at the time of our study, when we were looking backwards at pregnancy, it was still included at that time. But fortunately now, this is something that we don't have to be tremendously concerned about because it has been taken out of gasoline. Strangely, not because of health impacts, but because it had a funny smell.
So you mentioned the 155 or so chemicals that you find in auto emissions. Have every one of them been analyzed extensively, or is that a piece of work that is ongoing? You've identified two that have been problematic, but
yes,
that still leaves a long list of chemicals that we're still breathing.
Absolutely. So I can't sort of emphasize enough how little we know about not only the chemicals that are in the air, but the chemicals that may be here in the room with us, maybe coming from the floor coverings or coming from the electronic equipment in front of me. And, you know, that might be in the home of you as the listener, perhaps coming from your water bottle or your food. Generally, as environmental scientists, we use the number of 100,000 human-created chemicals now that are all around us. Studies are showing that many of them make their way into our blood. And I used to think that certainly those chemicals wouldn't be allowed to be used unless we knew that they were really quite safe. Unfortunately, that's not the way the regulation works. We're not looking for human health impacts. We're not looking for what I would call developmental impacts, meaning impacts very early in life, in pregnancy or in infancy or childhood. And we're definitely often not looking for impacts on the brain, which is a highly sensitive organ. So in terms of whether those 155 air pollutants have been very well studied, no, hardly at all have they been studied. Now, this may be cause for alarm, cause for fear.
I'm getting a little worried listening to this.
Yeah, so it not every chemical is certainly going to be bad. Not every chemical is going to be at a level that's going to be harmful. And yet, the question is that we don't know. The way these are regulated is they're given minimal testing sometimes, and sometimes none, because they've been used for so long that they're grandfathered in, and they're put out there on the market. So it is left to someone who is a researcher like me to really figure out whether they might be causing harm. It's one of the ways in which the role of the university is really a key foundation in terms of our societal goal to create a healthy environment.
Yeah. You know, as you describe all of the different ways in which we interact or come into contact with chemicals, it makes me think that, on the one hand, chemicals are beautiful, right? They help create the lifestyle that we have. They make possible so many of the creature comforts that we depend upon. But I think I, like many people, probably just presumed if it's being sold, somebody must have looked at it and said, yeah, it's fine. It's not going to hurt you. But that's not necessarily the case because, as you've just pointed out, a lot of these have never been checked to determine whether, in fact, there is a problem or not. So what does the average person do?
It's a really good question.
Except what more people like you.
Yes. I remember a few years ago, a friend of mine was looking to buy a house. It was near a large roadway. She had small children. And, you know, this is my good friend. She asked me, should I maybe take that into account? I did say yes. But how often in your life do you get the chance to buy a new house and to locate your house not to be close to a highway, let alone have maybe the financial resources really to always make those kind of choices? So this is one of those things where the good news is that we can work together. So I really refer back to what I call the public health perspective here. There are some problems that we really cannot tackle individually. And I'm sorry, listener, that I don't really have good news in terms of what you do today. We have to keep our eye on the societal level and also keep your eye on the long game. What do I mean by that? So you do have researchers at universities, including right here at UWM. You know, we're located within the School of Public Health, and we are researching things like air pollutants and many other things that could either protect or harm your health. In addition, public health also tackles, well, what can we do about it? Whether it's an educational intervention, whether it's a new kind of health access, or whether it might even be something like a national policy. So the long game here, I think, is going to be successful. I often go back to 1970, the birth of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the start of the Clean Air Act. And those efforts were successful. So you can look at the graphs of how air pollution in the U.S. really dropped after that time. And now you see the air that we have. It is so much cleaner than other parts of the world right now, where the air pollution is so bad that it's blocking the sunlight, where people are wearing masks when they go outside. So if it wasn't for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Clean Air Act, that's where we'd be.
But just because we have an Environmental Protection Agency and great success behind us doesn't ensure that that success will continue forward. As we take a look at the severe budget cuts that have been made to the Environmental Protection Agency by the current administration, rollbacks of clean air rules, telling automakers that they can't build better cars for less auto emission in states like California. So to the question of what can you do, I think focusing on public policy as well as the science goes hand in hand, doesn't it?
It does go hand in hand. One really needs the other. And it's certainly a balancing act. You mentioned the budget cuts and what we can do. I think that human nature is when something's working well, you begin to forget about it. We have had reasonably good air quality in the United States. And so most of us are not sensitized to the need to continue to keep an eye on it, either because it might be getting worse as our population grows, air pollution gets worse. You know, a changing climate itself is going to have a feedback loop to that air pollution, making it worse. So I do think it's a time for increased sensitivity and awareness of the environment around us. And I think that as a society, we are becoming more aware of how diet, the environment, and other factors are really contributing to the health of ourselves and those that we love.
And just because you can't see pollution or smell pollution doesn't mean it's not there. And that's why the ongoing testing is so critical.
I couldn't agree more.
Great. Amy, fascinating conversation. Congratulations on the success in getting this large grant from the National Institute of Health. We look forward to having you on as you begin to come to some decision points in terms of what does all of this mean as you try to figure out whether or not there are neurological problems caused by this pollution and what can be done about it.
Thank you, Tom.
Continue.
It's been fun.
and it's great having the conversation. Amy Kalkbrenner, Associate Professor of Environmental Health Sciences at the UWM Zilber School of Public Health, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. Thanks so much for joining us. Remember, you can listen to any of these programs at any time. Just go to the WUWM.com website and look up the UWM Today program. All of our shows are cataloged there going way, way back. So you could listen to Amy and many of her other faculty colleagues at UWM talk about the great work they're doing. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next week. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.